I'm Christopher Lydon with the American historian who knows the mind of Barack Obama as thoroughly, maybe even more clearly than President Obama himself. Professor James Kloppenberg at Harvard has written an intellectual biography of the president titled Reading Obama, Dreams, Hopes, and the American Political Tradition. The bumper sticker description of the president as thinker is civic Republican, small r. The question after a midterm setback is what that label means. Is there a problem in it? Or maybe a solution? This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. An American conversation with global attitude, we call it. We're in the Harvard History Department offices on the morning after the people elected a Republican House. You write that President Obama is better read, more thoughtful about American politics than any president since maybe Teddy Roosevelt or Woodrow Wilson. What is he thinking?
What I find so surprising about the coverage of Obama is that he is treated as an enigma, as someone that we can't quite figure out. When, before he entered the White House, he had written the two most substantial books that any person elected president had written since Roosevelt and Wilson. And in those books, he explains how he sees American politics. And he sees democracy as a deliberative process in which people with different points of view are forced to come together and to find solutions to problems that neither side could have found on its own. I think he went into his first term in the White House assuming he would be able to find those solutions through that same process of deliberation. I think that's why it took him as long as it did to begin making clear what he wanted to have happen about health care, because I think he thought that this process of bringing both parties together would actually create something. But he learned that it did not, and so I think it's conceivable that in this second 2 years, he may find himself in a situation where he must and can work with at least some members of the Republican Party who won't want to be marginalized, who won't want to be boxed into a Tea Party corner going into 2012. So it's conceivable that having a divided House and Senate will actually enable him to do the kind of governing that I think he imagined he would be doing from the start. But it's far from a foregone conclusion that it'll play out that way.
Sweeping general question, is he overthinking the job, people wonder? Or is there something odd about his thinking? It's strange that people still want to call him a Muslim or wonder if he's a socialist. But what is the problem here of a very thoughtful president?
The coverage of American politics generally, and of presidents in particular, treats it almost as a game. There is a level of cynicism that is very hard to miss. And I think it's hard for someone as thoughtful as Obama is to know how to enter that debate. He doesn't want to be shrill. He's only been partisan, really strikingly partisan, in the last few weeks as we approach the election. I think he really would rather change the conversation away from this partisan posturing to the kind of conversation he wanted to have, if you remember that celebrated day-long colloquy he had with Republicans over health care. Right. I think that's how he envisions the political process working. And when, in the audacity of hope, he described his experience both in the Illinois legislature and in the U.S. Senate, he talked about how valuable it was for people to learn to talk with each other and to find these new solutions to problems. I think he is probably puzzled by his inability to make that happen during the first 2 years. It's difficult for me to extrapolate from the record going into the White House and from what he told us in his books to what's going on now, because I think it is so unexpected, given what he has told us about how he sees American politics. I wouldn't say he's overthinking it, but I suspect he is getting advice that goes in diametrically opposite directions. On the one hand, be more strident, be more of a partisan. On the other hand, reach across the aisle, try even harder to bring the other side in. And so I think you can't do both of those at the same time, and I think he's done alternately some of one and some of the other, and we have mixed results. I mean, from a historian's point of view, if you look at it over the course of the last century, the legislative achievement of the first 2 years is breathtaking. the stimulus package, the healthcare package, financial reform, the educational initiatives. This is something that any president would be proud of. So the fact that he's not only being hammered by the right, because many conservatives would oppose every piece of that legislative agenda, but also from the left, because people came in with a fantasy vision of what he would be able to accomplish. This is the president of the United States, not a dictator. It's a man who has to deal with a Congress that was in many instances reluctant, including even members of his own party, to take the steps that he wanted to take. So I think the effort toward bipartisanship, to a certain extent you could say, yielded the health care plan. But should he then have crowed in triumph, as some people wanted him to do, or should he have admitted that this was a deeply divisive issue and that he thought the only way we would know the consequences of it would be to let it play out? I think that's what he genuinely believes, that like Social Security, like Medicare, it's a deeply flawed product of the sausage factory we call the legislative process. And we won't know for several decades whether we have gotten it more right than wrong, whether it needs substantial amendment or just tinkering around the edges, but it was the best package he could get through Congress. That, I think, is true. And I'd say the same thing about financial regulation. It wasn't the bill he dreamed of, but it was the best he could get.
This book of yours, Jim Kloppenberg, Reading Obama, wonderfully spells out what we half knew, that this man, Barack Obama, is immersed in a kind of philosophical reading of American history, most especially through the pragmatists, William James, John Dewey, Oliver Wendell Holmes, the Supreme Court Justice, but also that while he presided at the Harvard Law Review, he was in a cauldron of debate about social theory, John Rawls and such. Also that Jeremiah Wright is a significant intellectual influence on him with something known as the Black Value System. I wish you'd take each of those things, the pragmatism, the Rawlsism, the theory of justice, and that sort of black Christian thinking, and kind of bring them to bear on who he is and what he's doing now. I mean, they're still at the core of the man's thinking, I think.
Right. One of the things that fascinated me as I did the research was the conversations I had with the people who had taught him, beginning with his professors at Occidental, who introduced him to a lot of these thinkers, a process that continued as an undergraduate at Columbia. But then when he got to Harvard Law School, he arrived at a time when the legal academy was in ferment, when there was a sense on the part of conservatives that this was the time to roll back the achievements of the Warren Court. And what we know as originalism is a way of thinking about the Constitution that really comes into being during this period, during the 80s, when conservative legal scholars construct a way of thinking of the Constitution that would freeze it in time. Many conservatives up to that point had a very different approach to the Constitution because they realized that it needed to be interpreted in order to be consistent with the point of view that they had about the relation between the economy and the Constitution. What's going on at Harvard when Obama gets here is that there's a struggle between several strands of conservatism and an even wider array of people on the left. There are scholars who are involved in what's called critical race theory, who see race as the lens for making sense of American law and American power relations. There are varieties of feminist jurisprudence that are very important in helping Obama think clearly about issues of sex and gender. There are various forms of economic analysis on the left, and there is overarching an awareness that ways of thinking, not only inside the academy, but in cultures more generally, are human constructions, that there are no universal truths about questions such as liberty or equality or justice. The way we understand those ideals changes over time. And what Obama came to see is that they've also changed in American history. The Constitution emerges from a process of debate in which people who have fundamentally different conceptions of this republic are forced to compromise with each other in order to find a constitution that they can live with. The Constitution is never a fixed, unitary document that has an original meaning. That is a fantasy, as all the scholars who've written on Madison in the last two decades have demonstrated clearly. So Obama begins, as a student of constitutional law, with that understanding of the Constitution as something that emerges from a process of debate and as something the meaning of which continues over time to evolve.
He's a student all the while of Larry Tribe, who we associate with a kind of organic constitution, and Obama himself maybe contributes the notion of the Constitution as a conversation.
Precisely, precisely. Tribe credits Obama with having come up with that phrase in particular, and it's something that animates Obama's discussion of the Constitution and of the law in his writings. He sees this organic growth as the way in which we have to understand the Constitution, and he's willing to recognize that different people will continue to have very different perspectives on the Constitution. He's not interested in freezing his own view of the Constitution as the only one or the legitimate one. He sees this wrangling as what a democracy exists to enable. And so that, I think, is part of what makes him difficult for people on the left to understand, because he sees a kind of legitimacy in the points of view of people who disagree with him that many people on the left are not willing to acknowledge in their opponents. And so that awareness of the contingency of his own way of thinking, as well as the ways of thinking of other people, seems to me to be the mark of a very sophisticated and very thoughtful and self-conscious individual. But it seems to many people, not only on the right, but also on the left, to be a sign of weakness, a sign of spinelessness. Mm-hmm. And I don't see it that way at all. I see it instead as a sign that he got the memo about the transformation of understandings about culture that was so prevalent in the academy in the late 20th century. The difficulty we have is that by 2010, people want fixed truths. They want absolute answers. And as you pointed out, as a product of the ways of thinking that we associate with William James and John Dewey, Obama sees the problem with absolutes, that they can close off thinking and close off experimentation when what we need is fresh thinking and more experimentation.
Go back to that philosophical pragmatist thread. And the link is probably Oliver Wendell Holmes's famous line that the life of the law is not logic, it's experience.
Right. Right. And that, I think, was one of the key insights in the original pragmatist discourse, that just as the law has been changing over time, so all questions of philosophy, specifically ethics, questions of political theory, are questions to which there are not single answers in the way that there might be answers in a mathematical formula. And as a result of that, the philosophical pragmatists emphasize the role of experimentation and the critical evaluation of results. And in his legislative career, that's the approach that Obama has taken. One of the striking things about the Audacity of Hope is the extent to which he's willing to state his misgivings about Democratic Party orthodoxy and to acknowledge the ways in which Democrats had become captives to a closed system of thinking. He is willing to concede that there are some instances in which the free market, for example, might be a better approach to some social problems than government. But he also concedes that the mania for deregulation in the 90s got out of hand and was looking as though it was going to cause problems itself. We've now seen the nature and the extent and the lasting damage done by that deregulation. But already in 2006, he was beginning to say, I can see why we had to do some deregulation, but let's not get carried away. Let's assess the results of that. And so that experimental, philosophically pragmatist approach is, I think, what drives his approach to politics.
That critical examination of results is, of course, William James, who said that the judgment of an idea is not in its roots, but in its fruits. And I guess part of the question about Obama is that too mushy a guide to not political action so much as political leadership.
Well, that's the question that we would be wrestling with this morning. I think if you look at the legislative agendas and the achievements in domestic politics of Woodrow Wilson, a self-proclaimed pragmatist until his stroke at the end of World War I, of Franklin Roosevelt, who's powerfully influenced by people who are more attuned to philosophical pragmatism than Roosevelt himself was, and if we look at the achievements of the 1960s, we can see a number of legislators who think of themselves self-consciously as engaged in a process of experimentation. Now, if you're not looking for a leader who will declare for you for all time what the absolute truth is on any particular question, then that experimental approach looks very attractive. It also looks very consistent with a democratic frame of government in which people can disagree, they can make compromises, and they can then evaluate the fruits of those experiments. But if you're not committed to the possibility that your opponent might have a good idea, then you find this waffling, you find it weak, you find it insufficiently inspirational. Now, I think all of that seems a bit immature, seems a bit short-sighted. It seems to me that democracy requires people to be willing to admit that their opponents are at least sufficiently trustworthy to allow for elections. Henry Thoreau once said that democracy is a form of gaming, that you're putting to a vote something that, from Thoreau's point of view, in terms of the legitimacy of slavery, should not be put to a vote. There are some things that are just wrong, as slavery was. You shouldn't vote on them. You should go to jail to protest them. But on most of the issues that we face as a nation, what should we do about healthcare? What should we do about the environment? What should we do about the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan? It does seem to me as though there are no absolute answers. And so Obama is the sort of thinker best able to weigh the options, come up with a provisional set of strategies, then test those results, which is exactly what he said he intends to do in Afghanistan. By July of 2011, we're going to see whether the surge that the military recommended has had results. And if it has not, he says, we're going to start the process of coming home. Now, to me, that sounds like a philosophical pragmatist's strategy, but I would emphasize that there has always been spirited disagreement among people who think of themselves as philosophical pragmatists about the consequences in political policy or in policy questions of their pragmatism. And I think that's essential to the philosophy. It doesn't lead in a single line to one result rather than another. Pragmatists have always disagreed with each other. They always will disagree with each other. But the commitment to experimentation is what those pragmatists who disagree have in common.
James Kloppenburg, bring in the name of John Rawls and his Theory of Justice, a book that was all the rage in Obama's youth. I know it by the sort of bumper sticker version that, you know, when planning a society, think through the institutions you want if you don't know where in the pecking order you're going to be born or live. What part of his problem or his solution is that John Rawls inheritance?
Well, there are two parts to Rawls's argument. One has to do with that original position that you described. The other has to do with what Rawls believed were the two principles that individuals in that original position would come up with. One was the most liberty that you could have consistent with other people holding equal rights. And the second was what he called the difference principle, that any inequality in society has to be to the benefit of people at the bottom of that society. It's in some ways a very complex economist's way of making sense of the Beatitudes. What's striking about Rawls in A Theory of Justice is that he offers this as the way rational people would make these decisions. But over the next two decades, as this intellectual transformation that we were talking about Obama encountering at the Harvard Law School unfolds, Rawls changes his mind in response to critics and admits in his second great work, a book called Political Liberalism, that all a philosopher can do is offer what he calls provisional fixed points. Now, I see that as a deliberate oxymoron, a contradiction. If they're fixed points, they can't be provisional. If they're provisional, they can't be fixed points. But from Rawls's point of view, that's the best we can do. We inhabit our culture. We've inherited our traditions. given that particular standpoint, these are the principles we would embrace. So in some ways, the principles themselves change very little, but his way of framing them changes quite a bit. And I think Obama internalizes the second part of Rawls's career. Rather than assuming that we can, for all times and in all places, legislate the principles of justice, instead, this son of a cultural anthropologist comes to see that all cultures are particular and that their histories are determinative. Our history is a history of conflict. It's a history of deep disagreement. And the best we can do is find a way to incorporate as many different points of view as we can and muddle our way forward to solutions to the new problems we face. The idea that there would be a formula, that there would be a fixed original meaning of the Constitution is inimical to this way of understanding how cultures operate. And the great cultural anthropologist Clifford Geertz is the person we usually associate with this notion of cultural variability. And I think it is his work, above all, that shapes Obama's mother's understanding of cultural anthropology and that indirectly shapes Obama's understanding of culture, an understanding that is very much apparent in his account of the culture of Kenya or the cultures of Kenya that he encounters in his trip to Africa.
In a very, very partial roundup of sort of the key intellectual figures in his past, bring in Reverend Jeremiah Wright. He's a sort of banned figure now, but I have no doubt he's still a very, very important influence around questions of belief, but social action, community, and also a kind of double vision of American virtue from a south side of Chicago black church perspective.
Yeah. It's a very important part, I think, of the shaping of Obama's sensibility. When he goes to work in Chicago in the community organizing world, he finds himself in a Roman Catholic community. But he's reaching out to the various black preachers in the south side of Chicago, and it's only in Wright's church that he finally finds a home. And the account of his own conversion experience in his books is really quite striking and I think quite powerful, and to me it rings true as an account of how the kind of Christianity that Wright was preaching, which comes out of the social gospel of the early 20th century and out of the black church, made sense to Obama of his mother's lectures about the importance of empathy and his own exposure to people of faith and the difference they could make in the lives of the people he was working with. And so I take that conversion as a very serious story, and I take the role of Jeremiah Wright in facilitating that conversion as a very serious role indeed. In Obama's Philadelphia speech on Jeremiah Wright, when he distanced himself from his pastor,
threw him under the bus, many people thought.
Well, that's what many people said. I think that's not correct. I think that he's explicit in that speech in saying he could no more renounce Jeremiah Wright than he could renounce his grandmother. They're too much a part of who he is. And I think the shaping of that speech is really a very, very clear indication of how Obama thinks. What finally frustrated him about Jeremiah Wright was Wright's refusal to concede the possibility that American race relations could change. And Obama saw his own life as an illustration of how profound those changes had been. And just as his grandmother was the product of a particular way of thinking that he often felt was unfortunate, so that aspect of Jeremiah Wright's thinking seemed to Obama treason against America because it refused to accept the possibility that people could see things differently. I think Obama thinks in terms of changes over time, and he has seen during his lifetime fairly dramatic changes in race relations in America, although problems certainly exist, and there's nothing in that speech that suggests he's blind to those. That's the part of the response that I do not understand. He's very explicit about admitting both the power and the persistence of racism in America. And yet, he's also willing to concede that there is now evidence of cross-race alliances, of a softening of racial attitudes in many parts of the country, and that his candidacy at the time he gave that speech is a perfect illustration of that. It would not have been possible in earlier generations. So I think Wright has been an important influence. I think Obama's own Christianity remains an important source of value for him, an important North Star, as he called it in his Nobel Prize acceptance speech. And yet he doesn't share the faith that many conservative Christians have, that his Christianity gives him the answer to every problem that he faces. That, I think, is a Christian tradition that is in shadow right now, but is as old as Christianity itself. The belief that this faith in a transcendent God and a Christian message doesn't necessarily explain exactly what you should do in any particular ethical dilemma or any political circumstance in which you find yourself. That remains a challenge. It remains a quest for you to find that answer. And so I think that's why many conservative Christians who think their Christianity does give them knockdown arguments on political questions find Obama a very unfamiliar figure. But I would contend that this way of thinking about Christianity is at least as old, I would argue it's older because it goes all the way back to the Gospels themselves, than this dogmatist approach to Christianity that is attracting so much attention in America today.
Jim Kloppenberg, I can imagine President Obama calling you up and saying, you know, you've thought everything I've thought and you've written it down more explicitly than I could. Help me out here. After losing the House of Representatives, I can imagine him asking you, is there something wrong with my thinking, or is the problem that I haven't told people what I think and how I think, and spelled out a lot of these both processes and touchstones that you've identified?
I think he has no option other than to try very hard to build a bridge across to the other side of the aisle. And I think he will do that. I think that's his inclination anyway. And I think the question is going to be whether he can find a way to make clear the reasons why he remains committed to greater economic equality, for example, to a positive role for government regulation, without allowing people to paint a picture of him as someone who's very far to the left. He's not very far to the left. That's one of the reasons why I and many of the people who think as I do were not terribly enthusiastic about him initially, because he seemed a very tepid moderate. He seemed a Clinton-style triangulator. It wasn't really until I had read The Audacity of Hope that I realized I had this man wrong, that I did not understand either the depth of his commitment to equality or the reasons for it, or the reasons why he was willing to concede that we need to work with people who disagree with us in order to find solutions. The solutions lie in compromise and coalition building, not in the proclamation of our own self-righteous commitments that gets us nowhere as politicians. Fortunately or unfortunately, part of being a professor of history is that you don't have to deal with a Congress. And so all of us academics can take the positions we want to take and feel very good about ourselves without having to make those compromises. He doesn't have that luxury. He has to deal with people who disagree with him profoundly. What I find striking about him is the depth of his awareness of the legitimacy of their points of view. And that's what comes across so powerfully, both in Dreams from My Father and The Audacity of Hope. And I do wish the people who are so critical of him now would bother to read his books, because they would find someone much more self-critical, much more willing to see himself within a much broader conversation, a conversation that includes his Kansas-born mother and her parents, and that doesn't locate him in a place like the Harvard Law School. The notion that this man is an elitist strikes me, again, as myopic. He comes from a family of modest means. There's nothing in his background that suggests he was to the manor born. He arrives at Harvard Law School by dint of an enormous amount of work, and he establishes himself there by demonstrating not only that he's smart, but that he works extremely hard. And he established himself in Illinois politics in exactly the same way. So this is someone who, in many respects, is a classic product of the striving individual American dream, that you can make it if you work hard enough. And so that's exactly what he's done.
I want you to consider two other suspects here in the story. One is just us citizens. I mean, are we being lazy or unimaginative in our listening? But also, I want you to comment on the coverage of Obama. I'm not sure anybody has figured out how to report this man. and present him?
When he was not ranting and raving during the healthcare debate or during the debate over financial regulation because he was not able to persuade even members of his own party, let alone the Republican Party, to see things his way, I saw that as a sign of strength. I saw that restraint as a respect for the process and a respect for people who saw things differently. And I do think that that takes a kind of courage. But it's the reason I see it that way is that I see it rooted in this understanding of how impossible it is to find the absolute answer, which I see rooted in a Christian humility. But humility is not a virtue that we associate that much with the Christians who call themselves Christian most loudly in 21st century America. So I think we have difficulty understanding him because he doesn't have the same confidence that he's got the answer that many Americans expect their politicians to voice, perhaps even to believe. And it seems to me a mark of his maturity, his self-consciousness, his sophistication as a thinker to know that these are issues about which reasonable people may disagree. Now, that may not serve him very well in the era of Fox News, when what the people who attract attention like to do is simply shout louder than the other person and declaim with ever more self-righteousness that they are the only ones who have the answers.
Well, it also smacks at that old definition of a liberal as somebody who won't take his own side in an argument.
Well, and that's what frustrates people on the left. And if it were simply a case of him looking for the position midway between the left and the right, which I think is what Bill Clinton tried to do self-consciously, then I would be as impatient as others. But I don't see it that way. I really do see it as coming from a different place, coming from that civic republicanism that you mentioned at the start, coming from a conception of democracy as a process of deliberation. In his account of the Constitution, he gives us a detailed story about how James Madison goes into the Constitutional Convention, comes out saying nobody got the Constitution he wanted. What happened was we all learned to think differently as a result of the process of having to confront each other's ideas. I think that's how Barack Obama sees the democratic process. And we inhabit a deeply divided culture. When you listen to the pundits and the press reports on the election, it's as though America had been solidly Democratic and is now solidly Republican. It's more 51-49, 52-48. There are some races that were landslides, as there always are, but as a people, we're profoundly divided. We disagree about crucial issues. Now, how do you deal with that? You can be strident and simply be the uncompromising champion of your point of view, or you can say, let's see if there are issues about which we can find agreement. And Obama's entire life, from his years in college to his years in the community organizing world to his years at Harvard Law School to his years in legislature, both in Illinois and the U.S. Senate, has been a life of building coalitions, of finding points of agreement. And this is, I think it's fair to say, the first time in his life that he has had limited success doing that. That's what everyone who has known him remarks on. That's what defines this man. That's his genius, to find the way through beyond the disagreement to something that people can agree on. I think that's going to be still his objective in the next 2 years, and I hope it'll be his objective in the next 6 years.
Finally, what's your order to the citizens? I mean, do we have a hopelessly anti-intellectual public culture? Are we much more comfortable with presidents and politicians who don't think than one who does? Or is the citizenry onto something unsatisfactory here?
I think it's not entirely the fault of the citizenry. I think that it is also the fault of those of us in the academy and people in the world of journalism for providing simplified pictures on the part of journalists and for neglecting to pay attention to the role we're supposed to play, we people in the academy, in helping people understand the world they inhabit. My colleague Jill Lepore has written a book about the Tea Party in which she draws a striking contrast between the complexity of late 18th century American political debate and the diversity of points of view in the 1770s, and the very simplified, one-dimensional view of 18th century America that many Americans, especially those drawn to the Tea Party, consider to be accurate as a way of understanding America. Now, inasmuch as we have stopped writing for a popular audience, we've abdicated the responsibility that we have to make sure citizens in this democracy have an understanding of American history adequate to the task of making decisions. And I think as long as people carry these caricatured views of what America is and what America has been, it's going to be harder for them to make judgments than it would be if, for example, they understood how deep the commitment of people like John Adams and Thomas Jefferson was to the idea of economic equality. When people treat Obama's discourses on the importance of equality as somehow un-American or socialist, they're betraying what I see as a really frightening ignorance of what was striking to contemporaries in the late 18th century about American politics. When European observers came to the United States, what struck them more than anything else was that outside the slave South, there was very little difference between the most prosperous and the least prosperous Americans. Compared to European nations, this was the nation of economic equality. When Thomas Jefferson goes back to Virginia after writing the Declaration of Independence, the first thing he does is to file legislation in the Virginia House of Burgesses ending primogeniture and entail, which were the tools by which European aristocrats kept intact their fortunes so that they passed down to the firstborn son. Jefferson, Adams, Madison understood that unless there were rough economic equality in the United States, a democratic form of government would not survive. So this argument that any talk about economic equality must necessarily be un-American or anti-American has no foundation in American history. And yet, because academic historians who know better, who understand what a central part of American history that is, have stopped participating in these debates, we've left the field open for the mythologizers who would contend that 18th century America is about individual rights, it's about an original meaning of the Constitution, it has nothing to do with equality. All of that is a fantasy. Individual rights were always to be weighed against obligations. That's what civic virtue meant in the 18th century. That's what the Revolution was designed to accomplish. Equality was always not only equality against before the law, but equality socially and, in a rough sense, economically as well. Justice meant weighing individual rights against the demands of equality. So I think it is the case that when we trade in simplifications and caricatures in television and print journalism, we dumb down the electorate ourselves. We don't help them see that these are difficult issues. We encourage them to think in terms of cartoons. And I think it's important for people in universities to begin participating, as I'm happy to be able to do with you today, in trying to explain why the issues in contemporary politics seem to us as they do. And I don't by any means want to suggest that there's a single answer coming from the academy about any of these issues. There are people who would disagree with many of the arguments I've made to you today, and I'm aware of that. But hearing the range of positions and hearing people complicate what is often presented as a very simple set of questions, I think is the role that the academy should play in a democracy.
James Kloppenburg, welcome to the public maelstrom. I thoroughly enjoyed this book, Reading Obama. Now I want to read President Obama's review of it. But thank you.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. Our Brown University interns George Warner and Chantal Berman helped us get ready for it. The conversation isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.